welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Caroline Klein, co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today I'm joined by Taylor Petrie, author of the article, History and Theology of Trans and Non-Binary Individuals in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Which appears in the spring 2026 issue of Dialogue. Taylor is a professor of religion at Kalamazoo College and the author of several influential books on gender, sexuality, and Mormonism, including Tabernacles of Clay and Queering Kinship in the Mormon Cosmos. In this article, he offers a sweeping historical and theological analysis of how Latter-day Saint teachings on trans and non-binary identity have developed, and how trans Latter-day Saints themselves are reshaping Mormon theology from the ground up. We'll be talking about the history of LDS teachings, the experience of trans members, and the emerging theological work that he calls transing the tradition. Taylor, welcome. I'm so glad you are able to join us.
It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just dive in. So this article is sweeping. It accomplishes a lot. And I think it goes over really interesting territory that has not really been explored all that often. So I'm excited to talk to you about it. Part of your article traces this long and complicated history of how Latter-day Saint leaders have understood transgender identity. What surprised you the most as you looked at that history over time?
I think that one of the most fascinating parts about all of this is that Latter-day Saints don't necessarily have distinctive doctrines or teachings in their understanding of transgender identity, of non-binary identity. They tend to follow the broader trends of society, the society in which we live and we operate. And so you can kind of look back to see the various changes that the church has had around this issue and see the way that they're often following or responding to certain kinds of trends within the broader society. It suggests that in many respects, this is an issue that has also only more recently received greater attention. I think that the church kind of said a few things about it for a little while and then forgot about it for a long time and kind of come back to it in recent years. And so I think the way that it kind of comes in and out of cultural conversations and the way that the church is kind of responding to those shifts is another one of the things that becomes really clear when you look at the historical record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you saying in your article that things were quiet for a long time, but then in the 1970s, the discourse from church leaders kind of starts to pop up over and over again. And along those lines, I was wondering if you could tell us about the way that church leaders have often conflated transgender identity with homosexuality. And they've often kind of used this term gender inversion, which comes from, you know, the greater public discourse. How has that conflation shaped current policies and assumptions in the church?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's really helpful and important to understand the way that the terminology that we have for trans identity and non-binary identity, and they're not necessarily the same, are modern inventions, and that but they're attempting to describe phenomena that we see throughout history. You know, we can look back at some of the oldest texts in the world, all over the world, and find episodes, instances of individuals who reject the gender binary, who live as the gender that is not the one that they were assigned at birth. We have lots and lots of examples of this, and the different terminology that we see kind of developing over time is not always consistent, and sometimes that makes it difficult to identify, well, what exactly is this, right? Is cross-dressing in the 19th century, which becomes a huge moral panic in the 19th century, is that an example of trans identity or proto-trans identity? So there's a lot of questions around what we mean by that. In the late 19th century is when we start to see the terminology and some of the concepts developing in scientific discourse, particularly around psychologists who are attempting to describe this phenomenon. And they're seeing it as a mismatch of bodies and identities. And they're seeing it particularly that term that you use as an inversion, where one gender wants to become the other one in some way. And as they're thinking about it in the late 19th century, they're seeing it as a species of another term that they're developing at the same time of homosexuality. So they really are developing the concepts of homosexuality and trans identity in tandem with one another, where again, there's a sense that the gender of the person doesn't match up with the sex of the person in some way. And so that becomes a really powerful way that that throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, that scientists and then later religious individuals start to talk about and think about what trans identity is as a species of homosexuality, a sort of extreme version of that. So when church leaders do start talking about it and start using the terms trans and transsexuality, the first mentions that we know of that church leaders are talking about it don't come until the 1970s. And by then, trans identities had been relatively well-known topics of public conversation at the time. We have individuals from the 1950s who are starting to transition, and these become big news items. The development of transgender surgeries are happening in these years and really started ramping up and picking up. And it becomes a matter of kind of broader public consciousness as well. And so church leaders start to talk about it and start to, again, participate really in a sort of moral panic around it, not that much different from what's happening now as well. And they see it again as a part of that, like, this is the consequences of an extreme homosexuality, is that ultimately you will want to transition from one gender to the other or something like that. So there's a real kind of conflation of gender identity and sexuality as the dominant framework that they understand trans identities being a part of from the 1970s on.
Interesting. And is that discourse still alive today amongst church leaders, or has that kind of flown by the wayside?
I think it pops up every once in a while, where we see terms like gender confusion showing up a lot. And sometimes the way that it shows up is in terms of like this notion of contagion of homosexuality or trans identity, that it will, that children will see this and they'll be confused and it will spread to them and so on. And so we kind of see some of that every once in a while, but it actually is relatively late where the church announces a kind of formal break from that older ideology. And it comes in, I think, I want to say 2012, 2013, somewhere in there, where we have like the Mormons and Gays website and then Mormon and Gay website that the church puts out. And there's a little kind of like subsection on transgender identity and gender dysphoria where they start to make a distinction there. Mm-hmm. But those are the earliest references that we have where the church is identifying that these are not necessarily the same thing or that they're not necessarily connected. But all throughout, the 70s, 80s, 90s, even up until the early 2000s, you see church leaders talking in these terms that they are kind of related phenomena.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's move forward a little bit in time, at least, from the 1970s when we were talking a few minutes ago, to the 1980s and policy changes. So as church leaders are starting to, talk about this, engage in this discourse, they're talking about transgender individuals more and more, there come about some policies that they're starting to institute. And of course, since then, we've gotten several more policies or different policies or changing policies over time. And so I was wondering if maybe you could recount some of the most major kind of shifts in policy that we've seen in the last, 4 decades or so. And then also what these shifts reveal about what the church is thinking about gender today.
The first policy that we get shows up in 1980, and it's again after almost a full decade of church leaders condemning transgender identity in very harsh and strong terms. And they announced in 1980, the 1980 handbook, that undergoing transgender surgery, transsexual surgery, as they called it, would result in excommunication. And also any doctors who participated in it would also be excommunicated. So I think they're kind of borrowing the language around abortion at the same time period. They're kind of drawing on some of these, oh, doctors who do this are also complicit in some way. And so they see it as very serious sin, that it's automatic excommunication, right? They start to kind of wiggle around this a little bit. They drop a few years later the prohibition on doctors performing these surgeries. They change the language to elective transsexual operations a little bit later. And I think that if I were to read between the lines a little bit, I think that what they're doing is trying to count for intersex surgeries. Okay. Individuals who are undergoing a kind of gender transition in from the state of like being intersex to being more gender conforming on a gender binary. And so I think that they're trying to like wiggle. If I had to guess, that's what they're trying to do by calling these elective as opposed to non-elective transgender surgeries or transsexual surgeries is the language that they use. So they're kind of fiddling around with it. And then for the most part, as you note, they don't say anything for a long, long time, you know, and the issue kind of seems to die or at least fade away from their consciousness and their awareness. It's not until 2020, then, that we get a next major policy update. And this policy update starts to really wrestle with some of the evolutions of how transgender identity is being understood at that time period, as well as some of the nuances that the older policies simply didn't account for. The fact is that most people, trans people, don't undergo surgeries. Okay. Surgeries are expensive. You know, there are a lot of other methods and technologies, including hormone therapy, which are much more common than surgeries, which aren't accounted for by the policy whatsoever. And it's during these years that there are also a couple of really public battles and some private battles where the church is kind of trying to navigate some of these things, where BYU students are transitioning and they're trying to decide, well, is a mastectomy, is that a violation of this, right? Is top surgery versus bottom surgery? Like, what kinds of surgeries are meant here, right? You have Lori Lee Hall, who's working for the church at the time and had been a stake president and is an architect for the church's temples policy, is trying to negotiate some of these kinds of things as well. Is facial electrolysis a transgender surgery or not, right? And so the church is really kind of trying to figure out a lot of these things, as well as, again, non-surgical transitions, which were becoming even more kind of common in the 2010s. And so the church comes out with distinctions between hormone therapy, surgeries, and social transitioning, and is kind of trying to navigate some of these things. And in some ways, it's a little bit more accommodating, and in some ways, is less accommodating than the earlier policies. It kind of reduces some of the gray area, which, you know, in some respects is good because there's less differences among church leaders. But it also, you know, opens up some space for people to have hormone therapy, for instance, and that was a life-saving thing for a lot of people in those years as well. There's another major policy update in 2024 where they kind of scale back some of these things. They put in some new restrictions that trans individuals have to be monitored in their bathroom usage, and they have to have they're not allowed to be around children to work or teach children. If any transgender youth go on an overnight, there has to be like a parent or another adult that's to specifically accompany them. And so there are some new things, some new questions that start to arise, I think, that the church is trying to deal with in these things. But it's generally a kind of step back from some of the flexibility that was given in the 2020 policy. Sorry, I'm talking too long because there's a lot of policy here. But what does all of this say about how the church is thinking about gender? In a way, I think it's really important to recognize that the church is kind of trying to retrofit some of its teachings around gender to this issue, where they had originally been trying to sort of push back against feminism and push back against homosexuality and same-sex marriage. They're now trying to apply some of those same rules here and some of the same doctrines here to make it make sense. So they reinterpret the proclamation on the family in 2019 to say that it's specifically referring to like an anti-trans teaching, that it means biological sex at birth. So we start to get some reinterpretations of doctrines that are going on around this time as well. And in a way, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition where we're seeing some softening on issues related to feminism and even homosexuality in these years and a little bit more accommodating stances, while then pushing back even harder against trans people during these years, too.
Yeah. So interesting. And like you just kind of mentioned, that while restrictions have actually gotten more restrictive, worse over the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, when it comes to transgender individuals, they're pairing it often with a softer discourse, like a more loving discourse, a more gentle discourse. Do you have any thoughts about sort of why are they doing this? Like, why are they getting more restrictive at the same time their discourse is becoming less harsh?
Yeah, I think the church is really torn by two competing imperatives, right? And it's a difficult path to navigate, the one that they've chosen, which is to be exclusionary and also try to be inclusionary simultaneously, right? And so, they're not saying they got rid of the excommunication requirement, right? They no longer excommunicate you automatically, right? There are some accommodations that are made for trans members of the church, right? They want them to be a part of the ward and a part of the community, right? And so they're trying to be open and inviting while also still setting some limits on, well, here's how far we're willing to go. And so I think it's that tension between the sort of ethics of inclusion and invitation and openness and kindness and a sort of general Christian virtues right here, this is where our red line is. And that red line moves. We see that moves and shifts over time, right? Or is reinterpreted, gets reinterpreted over time. But I think that's really where the church finds itself in conflict with itself in many respects. Even just the 2020 and 2024 policies, they start out, one of them starts out with like, the primary thing is to be kind. And then here's our doctrines, right? And then the 2024 one switches it and says, here's our doctrines. And then we should also be kind, you know? So you even see like, which one comes first here? As again, I think a part of that broader story.
That's just so interesting. And I mean, I think one of the things that's jumped out at me about like the recent transitions in policy is that now transgender individuals cannot go to the meetings like, say, Relief Society, where they feel most comfortable, where they feel like they belong. And so it is kind of this irony that the church is trying to be more inclusive in some ways in their discourse, while instituting these policies, which are not going to be welcoming, they're not going to be inclusive. And in fact, like that 2024 policy is where I know a lot of trans people that were hanging on to activity, but that was the moment where they couldn't hang on anymore. So yeah. I guess this is sort of a thing where we will see the pendulum swing back and forth a tiny bit over the next generation or two. Just really, really fascinating kind of contradictions there. You did earlier mention the Proclamation on the Family that has this phrase in it about gender being eternal. And that recently, and of course, the proclamation is from 1995. More recently, however, and I forget the year, but I think within the last decade or so, that has been clarified, because no one exactly knows how to interpret that how to interpret that phrase. And I believe, was it President Oaks who has said that, I'll clarify what this means for you. It actually means biological sex at birth. That is what we mean when we say gender is eternal. And that raises some issues and problems. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about some of the theological and scientific problems that rise up when you're going to make a stance like that.
Yeah. So first I'll say, I think it's pretty clear and obvious that gender in the Proclamation on the Family is about gender roles. Yeah. And I, you know, when it says that these are characteristics, it uses the language of gender roles. It says presiding and nurturing, right? It has all this like that. That's what it's about. That's the context of it, is feminism, is responding to feminism and responding to same-sex marriage at the time. And so to sort of retrofit it to this issue has been a little bit of a tricky thing. And President Oaks in 2019 announces that what was always meant by saying gender is eternal is biological sex at birth is eternal. And I think that it raises a couple of tricky questions. The first is that from a scientific perspective, it's not clear what is meant by biological sex. There is, this is a sort of generic term, but there are a number of different ways that this is measured, none of which fully agree and none of which are ever 100% consistent. So for instance, chromosomes might tell one story of biological birth, but that doesn't necessarily always correspond to what the external physical representation might look like. The gonads might also be different from what the chromosomes or what the external physical representation might look like. So the morphology of the body doesn't always correspond to some of all of these other things. And there are a number of conditions in which this is the case. So when you go from biological sex at birth, it's not only unclear, well, what's the standard that we're measuring that by, which is the biological marker that we're looking at here, but also biological sex at birth is not binary. We already know that, right? So to say that gender is eternal means biological sex at birth is eternal. What do we do with intersex individuals then who don't fit into either of these two categories cleanly or clearly? It seems to sort of pose a real challenge there. I think the other theological point that many people have sort of pointed out here is to kind of take this snapshot of birth as the moment in which gender is like absolutely crystal clear, and that's the gender that you were before before you were born and after you die, right, is to take this particular biological characteristic and give it this eternal significance in a way that we don't necessarily do with other biological characteristics. If you have blonde hair when you're born, you know, if you then color your hair later on, are you going against God's plan for what your biology is supposed to be, right? Like, what are the limits on which sort of biological things are allowed to be tampered with, right? Are allowed to be mutated, are allowed to change temporarily or permanently, and which ones aren't, and why, right? Well, so we don't really have a clear reason why necessarily one over the other. And again, as we can get into this part a little bit more, but many trans individuals understand their biological sex to be given at birth, that it's embedded in their brain, that it's embedded in their hormones. And there are other ways in which, again, transgender identity is biologized. It's not simply a choice, right? That there are biological explanations for it. And trans people say, that's perfectly fine. I'm happy to concede that, right? My biological sex at birth was trans, right? And so so many people don't feel like it necessarily solves the problem in as clear of ways as maybe the church might want it to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, thank you. And speaking of this, you just kind of mentioned trans Latter-day Saints lived experience and lived understandings. And that is another part of your article that's really important and powerful. And you write about how in many accounts from trans individuals that they feel kind of pulled in two different directions between, you know, faith on one hand and their identity as LDS people on the other. And so I was wondering if you could maybe mention a couple of things, themes or anything else that kind of stood out to you in these personal narratives from trans individuals. And maybe along those lines also, you know, how they are navigating authority, given their own personal understanding and revelation and institutional teaching.
Yeah. We are so lucky. We really are living in a great time where trans voices are being listened to, recorded, published, analyzed in ways that we just didn't have from earlier eras. So, I mean, literally, if you go back 10, 12 years ago, there was almost nothing. And now we have this abundance of great information. So there are qualitative studies of interviews of people and telling their stories and their experiences. There are quantitative studies of trans individuals telling their stories as well. And we have a number of published accounts, many of which in Dialogue, which I'm really proud of. But others outside of in other presses and self-published of people telling their stories. And so we have really so many great materials that we can kind of draw some preliminary conclusions from. One is that there is no universal singular trans experience, that different individuals have different ones in both their local congregations, their particular life circumstances, right? No one story is the same. And so I think that's really important not to sort of always put everybody in one singular box. There are disagreements among trans people about how to relate to the church. Different ones respond very differently to matters of faith, right? Some are very devout and some are very, you know, not, right, as a result of their experiences in the church. And so we see a whole range of different responses, as you might expect. I think that there are some themes that we can draw on, and it's not difficult to conclude this from the rhetoric that we've seen and the actions that have been taken, that trans Latter-day Saints find themselves in a very difficult position in relationship to the church, that they often feel excluded, they feel stigmatized, they feel surveilled, not accepted, and the broader kind of anti-trans rhetoric that we see, I think, especially on the right in recent years, spills over into how they're treated in their local congregations. And so, I think that's a real tragedy, one that not only affects, I think, the trans individuals, but really affects the church as well, as we lose these people, as we lose their voices, their experiences, their perspectives, their wisdom from our communities. And so I think that's one trend to kind of keep our eye on, of the alienation that many trans individuals have. I'm trying to think if there are other ones that I wanted to speak about, because I got locked in on that one. Were there other ones that come up for you?
Well, I was thinking about that question of how they navigate authority, between personal revelation and institutional teaching. Yeah. And, one thing that comes to mind is the way that some of them, like you mentioned, there's no one narrative, embrace the idea of eternal gender, but they do reinterpret it. And so I was just wondering if you could kind of maybe walk us through how that kind of thinking might work.
Yeah. On that first one, thank you for reminding me of that. Many trans Latter-day Saints describe the experience of coming to terms with their trans identity, of negotiating, as you said, the kind of authority of the church versus the conflict of their interior experience, of their personal lived experience, acknowledging, recognizing spiritual experiences as the things that kind of help them navigate that. They pray about this deeply. They fast about it. They receive revelations from God about it, right? And describe these as deeply spiritual experiences, not again as one of like, I have to leave the church because I'm trans, but rather the church helped me understand, right? These teachings of the gospel helped me understand it, right? And so personal revelation becomes a really important way of kind of protecting themselves against what they see as the very harmful teachings of the church with respect to their identities. Again, they're also doing theology, right? As a part of this, it's not just a kind of appeal to a personal experience. They're taking seriously the proclamation. Many trans people are strong defenders of the proclamation on the family and say, yes, I have an eternal gender, right? This is what it is, right? And so they're not opposing it. They're actually interpreting it very much in line with their understanding of their identities as an eternal identity. And, you know, as opposed to saying that the body is a fixed thing, a biological sex is a fixed thing, trans individuals understand the eternal identity, that which existed before the body and will exist after this particular mortal body, as actually the more important thing. And that's the thing that is being kind of revealed in their trans identity, is who they really are underneath the kind of imperfect, immortal bodies that we have. And so they understand the body as the mutable thing and the eternal identity of the soul or the interior self as the fixed thing which can't be changed. And that's very different from the way the church understands, is the body is the fixed thing and the soul is the thing that needs to be changed or manipulated in some respect. So you really see this kind of conflicting understanding often between these two different interpretations of, well, which is the true self, right? Mm-hmm. Is it the body or is it the soul in some way? And which is mutable and which is not?
Ah, interesting. So interesting. And you do so many other fascinating things in this article as well. One of which is you introduce this idea of transing LDS theology, and rethinking concepts like we've been talking about eternal gender, also embodiment, also divine archetypes. Can you just quickly maybe explain to us what transing means? And this is really interesting to me. How does it differ from like feminist or queer approaches?
Yeah. It's closely related methodologically to those as well, but it's really about normalizing or understanding trans identity not as exceptional, but as a normal process, right? To understand that there are ways in which the gender binary doesn't always hold up theologically in the tradition as well. And so one classic example of this, and it comes out of Orthodox teaching and feminist teaching and queer teaching, right, is that when Christ is in the Garden of Gethsemane, he takes on all of our identities and fully understands all of our identities. And if that happens, then he has to become a woman, right? Then he has to become a trans person. Then he has to become something which is outside of his supposedly eternal gender identity, which is to blur all of these boundaries, right? And that's a widespread understanding of who Jesus is, which suggests that such transing is possible, right? That it's not only possible, it's at the center of the Christian tradition, right? So what transing means in this context is to take to see trans identities and to see trans practices and to see trans ideas in the things that are kind of already there and already normally happening. They're not necessarily exceptional. They're very much already built into the story. And there are a number of ways in which these different theologies inside and outside of the church are kind of transing traditional theology in order to kind of point out these blurry distinctions between genders as sort of openings or spaces to kind of rethink transness as a normal human activity.
That is exciting. That is exciting theological work. And I am looking forward to more and more of that being done. But before we wrap this up, how about one more question, which is kind of the big vision question. As you kind of step back and, you know, look at, you know, think about the history, the policy, the theology, the lived experience, everything you cover in your article. Where do you see things going in the church? What is unresolved? What still needs to be wrestled with? And yeah, can you take a guess as to what the future holds when it comes to trans individuals in the church?
Oh, I don't know.
I know it's hard.
I say this all the time. Historians are not fortune tellers. If we were, you know, we would all be rich or something. I don't know. By being able to predict the stock market, so it's hard to say where things are going. It seems from observing the present in 2026 right now that the polarization on this issue is not going away anytime soon. I think that the anti-trans backlash that helped to fuel the 2024 election, you know, still animates a lot of the right wing. I think that it informed the way that the church kind of set up some further stakes in their 2024 policies on trans identity and trans individuals. And, you know, it's hard to unwind those, especially for a pretty small minority of individuals, right? This is, 1 to 2% of the population, right? And so it's difficult to see how the church kind of threads the needle on this broader culture war. And we may be, just as we are on feminism and homosexuality, in a multi-decade long struggle on this particular topic, where the church may make some accommodations, may pull some back. You know, we're going to see some people, you know, strongly oppose it, and some people maybe try to be a little bit more understanding and inclusive, you know. So it's not really clear that there's a path out of all of this, as a reflection of where we are culturally right now too, right? It's an issue which is quite divisive, and which around which there's just a lot of misunderstanding as well. So I think that I can expect many more years of difficult conversations around this issue. And at the same time, I want to say that it's really heartening to have seen how many trans individuals are coming out in the last 10 or 15 years, telling their stories, standing up for their values and their identities. And it's I don't expect that to go away anytime soon either. So, yeah, I think we're in for a long and fruitful set of reflections by other trans individuals, by those who have already been out and those who are coming down the line, to keep thinking through this issue in sensitive and critical ways and telling their stories. And again, this is just, we're just at the beginning of this in some ways.
Mm. That's a great note to end on. Taylor, thanks so much for joining us today and just for your the really important work that you're doing on this topic and on other topics related to gender and Mormonism. To our listeners, you can read Taylor Petrie's article, History and Theology of Trans and Non-Binary Identity in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in the spring 2026 issue of Dialogue. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends or colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or reach out with your comments and questions. Be sure to subscribe to this show and explore the other great podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network. This has been Caroline Klein. Thanks so much for joining us.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.